It's time for Windows Weekly. I'm here, but Paul Thurrott and Mary Jo Foley are in Seattle. Yep, day one of Build. We'll analyze all the big announcements Microsoft had made with additional visits from Brad Sams and Richard Campbell from .NET Rocks. Windows Weekly's next.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Windows Weekly with Paul Thurrott and Mary Jo Foley, episode 620, recorded Monday, May 6th, 2019, live from Build. Windows Weekly is brought to you by ExpressVPN. Protect your online privacy with one click. Yeah, it's that easy. For 3 extra months free with a 1-year package, go to expressvpn.com/windows. And by Prylock Security. Teach your employees how to keep your company secure by avoiding phishing emails, candy drops, and social engineering. Show them how and why hackers attack with training from Prylock. Go to prylock.com/twit and use the promo code Leo to save 30%. And by Atlassian. Atlassian's software powers the full spectrum of collaboration between IT teams and the rest of your organization. Visit Atlassian.com/IT to see what IT could be by giving their products a try for free. It's time for Windows Weekly, live from Microsoft Build in Seattle, Washington. I bring you good tidings of Mary Jo Foley and Paul Thurrott, who've been working a long day, especially since they worked a long night last night. Hello, Paul. I'm Mary Jo.
Hello.
How are you feeling?
I feel great. I don't know about Paul, but
I've had a rough day.
So Build is underway. Just the first day of Build, you're kind of right in the middle of it. And I imagine, you know, there's 2 more days, so imagine there's lots more. Are you missing anything important by doing this show right now?
I hope so. I don't think so. They did the second keynotes, and it's probably just sessions. We don't have any meetings scheduled for this time frame, obviously, because we're here. But
so the second keynote was Scott Guthrie's keynote.
Well, there were two you could choose from.
Okay.
The other one was Rajesh Jha, who is the guy who heads up Microsoft 365. So he had the more Windows-centric one of the keynotes.
Yep.
Yeah, and Satya Nadella, who kicked things off, and we actually streamed the Satya Nadella keynote, followed by your exegesis at the end. He was doing the vision thing, but mostly, you know, he's replaced Steve Ballmer.
When
Ballmer's,
you said exegesis, I thought you said next to Jesus.
Next to Jesus, Satya Nadella.
Close.
He's next to Jesus. No, it wasn't even really a vision thing. He's replaced Steve Ballmer's developers with partners.
Yeah, but you know what? This is still a better format than previous vision keynotes, because I think he might have droned on too much in the past.
It wasn't as long, that's for sure.
No, and I thought it was more relevant to the attendees than maybe previous versions were. So I thought it was okay.
Okay, good. You didn't struggle, Paul and Mary Jo, afterwards to kind of find some nuggets?
No, and actually, by the way, there's a good point, right? Because last time, I guess that would have been at Ignite. We struggled, and Mary Jo in particular, actually, embarrassingly for Mary Jo.
Guys, I was just going to be honest and say, I don't know what that was, but there wasn't a lot of there.
I talked her off the cliff.
You did. But
so
today,
there was more meat. You think there was more meat in this matter?
There was, because he started out really high level, but then he actually started talking about things kind of deep in the weeds that developers care about.
That's right. You have to really consider the audience. And the fact that a lot of people who are here have kind of different paths they're on. It's probably even more true in the IT show at Ignite. And, you know, you have to kind of sit through a lot of stuff to hear the couple of tidbits that you care about sometimes. And I thought the Ignite one went on too long and was a bad example of that. And then this one I thought was more on point. And the way they split up the keynotes, I think, made more sense for attendees too. So
good.
It was good.
Yeah. Well, and it was interesting to watch Nadella become animated when he really got into you could tell he not only knows his stuff when it comes to the cloud, he loves it.
There was a you probably didn't notice it, but there was an embarrassing demo fail right at the beginning.
So what happened at the beginning there?
So mean, well,
you got John Knoll on stage, the guy who, with his brother Thomas, created Photoshop. Now he's creative director at Industrial Light and Magic.
Yep.
Scott Chaykin with him. They're both wearing HoloLens 2s.
Right. They were ready to do a demo of the moon landing,
which was 50 years ago this next month in July. Yeah.
Right. And then something went bad, and they were as stunned as everybody else and just walked off the stage.
So if you watch the Scott Guthrie keynote afterwards, there were some demo fails at that time with Scott Hanselman and Scott Guthrie. And there's a good example of professionals handling it well. Hmm. These guys from ILM did not handle this well at all, and to the point where the camera followed them off the stage. I think everyone thought it was part of a joke and they were going to have this awesome demo. And what do you say? Thank you for your time or something.
Thank you for your time. Bye.
It was total Michael Bay time.
Yes, that's exactly what it was.
It was like when Michael Bay at the Samsung keynote some years ago at CES, the prompter failed, and Michael Bay just shook his head and slunked off stage.
Yep.
Oh, wow.
Yep.
Wow.
It was exactly like that. And, you know, and that's why when it happened, I said, well, that's how you know the moon landing was faked.
People in the chat room are saying, you see, moonshots are hard.
Yeah. Well, so that's, by the way, that's in some ways the worst aspect of this fail. It's bad when, demos fail, whatever, but they had purposely put language all over the keynote related to space at NASA. Yeah. So there was the term moonshot, mission control. Like this was spread throughout the.
Was there somebody rapidly typing at the teleprompter or did they leave it in?
They left it in.
So, too bad.
Do you guys remember? I mean, there are a lot of famous demo fails in Microsoft history. Another one is Chris Capossela with Bill Gates. Do you guys remember that one?
Wow.
Windows 98, I think it was, where Chris Capossela plugged a scanner in on stage while he's demoing for Bill Gates.
Yeah.
And the whole thing goes blue screen.
Yeah.
And then Chris Capossela steps back and he's like, whoa.
That's not what you want to hear.
So what show was that at? Was that TechEd or?
PDC.
Can we bring in Brad Sams is with you too, and I can bring him into the conversation.
But the year after the Chris Capossela thing, Bill Gates came up in the same show, and he said, you might remember last year we had the USB fail last year with Windows 8, and he said, I just wanted to reassure everybody that he still works at the company, and I yelled out, yeah, he's parking cars.
So, Chris, I know you're listening, but it just shows you can go on to redeem yourself after something like this happens.
That's right. He did okay for himself, I would say.
All right. Yeah.
He did all right. Wow. Brad Sams is also with you. Let me push some buttons. I think I can do that.
Magical buttons, hopefully.
Magical buttons. Hello, Brad Sams. And then if I push this button.
If you could push Paul's buttons, that'd make me happy, too.
I'd like to. No, I can no longer. Oh, Lord. Could you help me, please? I can't get Brad into the conversation anymore.
It feels like high school all over again.
I guess I could put him in this way.
Jeez.
In the bunny suit. Eight?
Yeah.
Well, thanks for coming, everybody.
We are out faster than a build demo.
So, just for future reference, let's not have build conferences when Alex Gumpel's day off hits.
Or vice versa.
Yeah.
We knew they were going to be guests. We've known for weeks they were going to be guests. Okay.
Well, we can keep talking while you guys are adding.
I don't know.
We have him in that third slot.
Yeah, we can still. Brad is still, we can hear him. We just can't see him.
Brad is from the overtones above.
It does sound like he's coming.
You can hear him because he's kind of like a mouth breather.
Brad, just lean your head into Mary Jo's shot so we know you exist.
Well, he's
across the room.
I guess he could probably.
No. We can adapt and improvise.
No, that's good. We don't, it's too much.
Yeah, so we're on the wrong sides of each other because actually.
I know. I saw you looking over Mary Jo.
Right,
yeah, no.
Sort of, I can't see her. Right, I'm over here somewhere.
Yeah.
Where is he?
That's really weird. All right. So demos go bad. That's fine.
They do.
I have to say, as somebody who really has zero interest in enterprise computing, there was really nothing in there for me, I don't think.
Oh, I see. First of all, a developer show.
Well, I'm interested in development, but...
Yeah. Right. So there's you're not going to hear a lot about client-side development beyond some things about Edge and so forth. Which
the
we'll
fluid
the
fluid framework was interesting.
Yeah, we got that in here. We got more things you're going to like, Leo.
And I got an email from somebody you might know, the host of This Week in Enterprise Technology, Lou Maresca, who sent us a note saying, for those of you interested, here's a shameless plug for the Microsoft 365 part of the keynote today where the Office platform's JavaScript custom functions will be demoed.
Well,
do you remember that?
No, I was
neither
no.
do I. This is the culmination of a long journey in engineering to get this to work for my team. Excel custom functions
and journey is overused these days, I would say, at Microsoft.
Yeah.
The customer journey is one of those things they talk about a lot.
Yeah.
A journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single JavaScript command. That's all. That's all I can say.
A single semicolon.
Single semicolon. What do you want me to do now, John?
If I use my mouse
and click on 5 here,
and click on 5.
You see, if you move it in a circle, the little cursor on the screen will also move in a circle. Oh, geez.
There he is.
And then 4, and then 3. What do you want me to do?
5, 4.
They're trying to figure out how the computer works.
Aren't we all?
I can get Brad single.
Digital numbers can be expressed with a 0 or a 1. Brad is a 0.
But you don't have a triple box anymore?
Aw, guys.
They just keep coming.
They're just so mean to Brad.
Paul is laughing so hard he might fall out of his chair.
There we go. All right. Okay. We've got the buttons. I guess we can go through in order. I mean, the only thing I understood at all, frankly, was the stuff about Credge.
Yeah.
And I was kind of hoping that Satya would call it Credge.
Actually, I think we need to do – Brad's got a meeting he's got to get to. So
okay, let's do Brad's stuff.
Let him skip ahead.
So we're going to start with gaming.
Sorry, Mary Jo. Paul, lean to your right just a little bit. I know you're avoiding Mary Jo.
They didn't actually do an xCloud demo, per se.
No, they didn't.
Which I was expecting.
But they did talk about the gaming cloud. And they said that we have 3 clouds. We've got the AI cloud, which is Azure, and the productivity cloud, which is Microsoft 365. And then we've got this gaming cloud.
Yep.
Which apparently, as far as I could tell, features a quick basic game written by Bill Gates in 19...
Oh, the Donkey game.
Yeah. Donkey. Donkey.base.
Yep. But there's more.
There is more.
That was kind of cool, though. I immediately went to the GitHub and I saw the code.
Rich legacy of stealing things from other people. He made a Frogger clone of some kind.
It wasn't Frogger. It was more like the driving game. Stuff. What was that driving game? Night Driver. Anyway, it was cool. I went and looked at the GitHub code.
Yeah,
it was fun.
But what about Genoa?
Genoa. Did you know? Actually, so Microsoft, Paul. So at the end of the keynote there, they tossed in a little teaser, a little extra, a little kind of very much out of the right field. I don't think anyone was expecting this. A Minecraft teaser for an AR version that is codenamed Genoa, which is what I found. I've known about this for a while. The interesting thing here is I'm pretty sure this used to be a HoloLens game. And that it was going to be built for that. I think they were kind of expecting there to be some sort of consumer play at some point with HoloLens. And then they went and kind of rebuilt it again. And what they ended up showing off here is an AR-style Minecraft game running on what looked like an Android or iOS device. What I'm hearing is that it's very much like Pokemon Go and that you have to walk around and you'll be able to dig things. But this is going to be the next great extension, if you will, of the Minecraft universe. And we'll see how Minecraft evolves from here. But that's how they ended their developer keynote, was with a gaming announcement before E3.
Well, it was just a video. It wasn't even an announcement.
Yes.
They just played it. They didn't even introduce it. They just played it.
Yeah, and I think they're going to talk more about it on the 17th. On May 17th is when we will learn more, which, again, is still odd. They have a major E3 conference about 3 weeks after that. But anyways, May 17th, we're going to learn a lot more about this game.
They had to have something gaming related because ahead of time when they briefed us, they talked about those free clouds, gaming on par with Microsoft 365 and Azure somehow, and there was really no gaming anything. That's why I sort of assumed there was going to be an xCloud demo, but
I did too. Yeah,
it was still pretty interesting.
Yeah, so we'll see how this shakes out, and everyone can keep their proverbial phones looking upward for more Minecrafters right. in the future. Yep. There you go.
I mean, it's like Pokemon Go, right, except using Minecraft characters. I think it could be big for kids, right?
Yeah. It's there's so many unknowns, right? We don't know how you're going to have to pay for it. Is it a part of Game Pass? Is it a right. part of Xbox Live Gold? How do you play with your friends? You know, we don't know all the details yet, which is fine. But if the true idea is that it can get you out moving around, it's a perfect launch time because we're heading into the summer season in the northern hemisphere, at least. And so the timing might be right. We'll see how quickly this comes around the corner to actually getting onto our phones.
Yep.
And they gave a date for that, didn't they? They said, June 17th? I can't remember what the date
May 17th.
May 17th.
They're going to tell us more.
Oh.
Than, so.
Is that the Minecraft 10th anniversary party.
Right.
Notch is not invited.
Okay.
Their notchless celebration.
Notchless.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, there we go. Thanks, guys. Right.
That's it? That's you? That's what you're over?
I don't know. I mean, I've got meetings. I've got other stuff. I've got to rip on Paul for a little bit.
That's fine.
Frankly, Brad's a little tired of the abuse.
Okay. Thank you, Brad. Brad Sams from Petri and Therot.com.
Thank you, Leo.
Always a pleasure. Thank you for joining us. Bye. I'm cutting his mic. Okay. Moving right along.
You're going to let us keep your mic.
You get to continue to talk.
Oh,
yeah,
right.
Actually, and I guess is Richard Campbell going to step in?
He's going to come here at the top of the hour, so in about 36 minutes.
And he's going to talk about databases.
Database stuff.
It's going to get dense. So let's go.
It's going to be like, yes, here we go with the enterprise. But before that, we have a lot of non-enterprise stuff.
Good. Let's take a little break because I know there's going to be a little bit of a shorter show. We don't have picks or anything. I want to get some mentions for our sponsors in here. And it'll give us a chance to remove all evidence of Brad from the room.
Exactly right.
our show today brought to you by ExpressVPN. If you if you're online on a public Wi-Fi, you might want to be thinking about protecting yourself. I think a lot of us say, cybercrime wouldn't happen to me. There's nobody going to hack me. But honestly, when you're on a public Wi-Fi, you're a sitting duck. And we do it all the time, don't we? Not just to hackers, but to snoops, privacy snoops. In fact, when you're using your internet service provider, they keep track of everything you're doing and often send it to the highest bidder for ads and other things. The best way to protect yourself on a public Wi-Fi, to protect yourself from snooping by your carrier, your ISP, or the Starbucks at the corner, is a VPN, a virtual private network. And the best VPN, ExpressVPN. It secures and anonymizes your internet browsing by encrypting your data, hiding your public IP address. It's easy to use. They've got apps for every platform. One button, boom, you're protected. One button, boom, it's off. So it's very easy to turn it on and off as you need it. It runs seamlessly in the background. And it's fast because ExpressVPN has servers all over the world. There's another good thing about that. That means you can emerge onto the public internet in one of many other countries. So any geographic restrictions, gone. If you emerge in London, you look like you're in the UK. You surf safely on public Wi-Fi. You protect your privacy. You eliminate geographic restrictions, and all of that for less than $7 a month. ExpressVPN. TechRadar rated it number one in VPN services. It comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee. Protect your online activity today. Find out how you can get 3 extra months free with a 1-year subscription when you go to expressvpn.com/windows. Turn that public Wi-Fi into a private Wi-Fi with your own virtual private network. expressvpn.com/windows. 3 extra months free with a 1-year package. We thank them for supporting Windows Weekly, and we thank you for supporting Windows Weekly by using that special address, expressvpn.com/windows. Paul Therot, Mary Jo Foley, they're in Seattle. Build Day 1, Microsoft's big developer conference. I expected a developer conference to talk about languages, frameworks, software.
Yeah.
This was more about Microsoft's partnerships to me.
No, I don't know. The Vision keynote is what it is, as its name implies. It's kind of a higher level type thing. If you watched the other two, you would have seen some coding occurring. You would have, it would have been more technical.
Okay.
Microsoft certainly does. Look, I mean, for example, one of the big things that's happening is .NET 5, right? And .NET 5 is the successor to both .NET Core, which is the open source cross-platform version of .NET, and the .NET Framework, which is the proprietary legacy version that they created first and only for Windows. And, you know, this is the combination of those two platforms. It's the future of the platform. It's all about developer. It's all about languages. In fact, in .NET 5, they're going to support Objective-C and Swift, which is kind of huge.
That's
and
cool.
So
yeah.
You do see those
Apple
types of stories.
Yeah. Yeah.
You do see that kind of stuff. You know, in years past, you know, obviously TypeScript would have been a big thing. Anders Heidelberg's latest language and whatever. I mean, but there's all kinds of different developer topics. So
this is more like a keynote that you would see at a sales conference or, you know, more of an enterprise conference. It wasn't even Vision. I'm used to Satya Nadella talking about, remember, he was, I think, the first tech CEO to use the word ethics in the keynote.
I mean, he mentioned ethics, right? And he tried to bring it back to developers and said, you know, we're talking about AI and ethics, and it's up to you, the developers, to make sure that happens when you code something. But back to the partner thing. So remember, partners these days for Microsoft are their customers. And when he kept talking about partners, what he meant was, you know, the reason I'm going to show you this 10-minute Starbucks demo is because Starbucks has a ton of developers who work there. And so we're also having in this audience people who are developers who work at our customers. And we're trying to talk to them because we're working hand in hand with these kind of developers to build new AI things, new mixed reality.
You got to parse the language. Mary Jane and I have both complained about the use of partnership to describe what is essentially customer relationship.
Yeah.
And so the interesting thing you get into there is, well, what happens when there's an actual partnership, right? Microsoft is.
What do you call that?
Collaboration, you call it. You basically have to shift the language.
Okay.
But, you know, interestingly, after our little bit on Channel 9, we got off the stage and we bumped into a couple people. And one of them was a gentleman who was a professor at a university who had adopted a bunch of Microsoft technology and was talking about how quickly they were able to onboard things and get up and running and how vastly superior the programming interface was and everything. And you know, that's the kind – that's the audience. And in his case, also, he's a presenter. He was talking during one of the sessions, I guess, this week as well. But, you know, that is what's happening here. You know, there will be talk of advances to languages and APIs and SDKs. You know, part of the deal around that .NET 5 thing I was talking about was the steps that Microsoft took last year to open source things like WPF and WinForms. And that sort of makes sense when you think about what's happened since, which is the thing I just described where, you know, they're basically open source now is the default for all of Microsoft's programming efforts. You know, this is where they're going.
Yep.
So it's got, you know, that stuff's all there.
I agree with Leo, though. I did expect more high-level vision from Satya, and I think it actually probably was good he didn't do that in a way.
Yeah, because often that is way too spacey, airy-fairy.
Right.
Exactly. I think it's a little disrespectful to the audience. That's what I meant. I feel like they did a better job with that part of it than they had in the past, for sure.
Me too.
It's going to be, you know, tomorrow's Google I.O., and it'll be really a big, I think it's going to be a big contrast between what Sundar Pichai says on stage to developers and what Satya Nadella said on stage.
So you say that, but you know, you'll agree with this, I think. The Sundar Pichai stuff is usually pretty short, for one thing.
They get him off fast.
Mm. You know, Google I.O. is a lot of, here's what we're doing in Photos.
Right.
Here's what we're doing in Hangout
it's
Meets.
It's showing off technologies.
But you know, you could also make that argument, or even Google or Apple's WWDC, the press event, you know, the announcement that everyone watches, is aimed at a broader audience than developers. Right?
This was the press event. I understand it wasn't.
Yeah, you have to look at it in the context of their audiences. You know, the Google stuff is here's our Google end user apps.
Yeah.
That are using backend services that maybe developers can use on their own. Maybe they'll inspire you to do something. The Apple stuff is all about talking directly to consumers and the audience that developers want to reach. you don't hear a lot about Swift language improvements or whatever, even though that stuff all
happened. But I can remember at Google I.O. when they announced, and now we're going to support Kotlin, people practically jumped on their seats. I mean, that was...
they finally heard something developer-related.
Yeah.
Well, maybe that was it. I didn't feel like there was a lot of developer news. This was more about... It felt more like Satya Nadella saying, look at all the people, the companies, using our technologies.
Yeah.
In particular, using Azure.
So here's, this is one of, Microsoft has several core strengths, I'm sure. But one of the big ones, and this is something they've been very consistent over the years. And I don't feel that they've ever disrespected developers per se. I mean, I think they've always done well by developers. But the key area that they do well is they know that their developer base is developing a sort of a skill set that's wrapped around a .NET and .NET style conventions and languages, and that they always give you new avenues to take the skills that you have and apply them elsewhere. And in the past, that would have been something really basic like, well, you're a Windows developer and maybe you're doing, Win32 with C++ or something. Well, now you can develop add-ons for Office or something back in the day. Today, they've really opened up the funnel. It's like a much, much bigger area because of all these Azure services, the Microsoft 365 cloud services, services. Soon it will be the xCloud and the gaming services. There's things that are out on the side like the Power Builder.
Power Platform.
Excuse me. And Dynamics and so forth. And so once you're in this world, once you're in that ecosystem, adopting another set of APIs that all have similar conventions and a similar way of doing things and work in the same developer environment, it just makes you more valuable as a developer. Comparing it to like an IT pro thing, it's like if you came up in the world of Exchange and Exchange was all you ever did, getting into SharePoint or Teams or whatever, it would be a little more difficult, where I think for developers, this has been a great journey, to use Microsoft's overused term. I just threw up a little in my mouth when I said that.
Paul and I hate enterprise, but that's the real problem here.
You know what else is happening at the same time? So the build and before build, PDC, they used to be talking to developers about, here's how to build apps for Windows.
Right.
Here's the tools on your Windows PC you can use to build a Windows app. That was it, right? And now they're trying to push developers to the cloud.
Well, but hold on real quick. You have to think about why, right?
Yeah.
And the why is that is a much bigger opportunity today. Bigger opportunity.
Definitely.
It's not because Microsoft has some ulterior motive about where they're headed as a company, although they do. But if you're looking at your developer base or any developer base and you're saying, well, look, you may want to develop apps for Windows, that's a kind of a small
– it is.
It's not niche-y per se, but it's a smaller audience. When you talk about developing for the cloud and for this vast number of services they have in Azure and elsewhere, it's a bigger pie.
Yeah.
But that's why it feels so different, right? Because before, we kind of knew what to expect. It was like, Don Box and Chris Anderson would get up there and they make some ankle bracket jokes and then everybody would laugh and it'd be great. And Now it's like, guys, we're trying to tell you where you should be going with your career. You should start looking at Azure and the bot framework and all this.
Don't get me wrong. I miss those days. And to be clear, that is where my heart is. And so when you think about something silly even, like when they moved to Windows 8 and they introduced all of the developer technologies, what became Universal Windows Apps and so forth, and they talked about how you could do XAML-based canvases with the language of your choice, C#, J#, probably. They didn't have F# yet, whatever the language choices were, I think C++ as well. And then they had JavaScript, HTML, and it was a completely different kind of environment and a different way of doing things. And it was exciting. Like to me, for me personally, those are the types of things where I think, like, I might be able to do this. Like, I'm interested in this. I might want to do this.
But we're not, we're not pro developers.
No, and I'm not prone to getting excited about any of the
data
enterprise
lakes.
Services. My eyelid like literally drooped when you said that. But that's just me. I'm not trying to.
I was hoping to hear, and I'm sure you were too, Paul, a little bit. I'm sure there's going to be tracks about it, but things like progressive web apps.
There's tracks about that.
Yeah.
And I'm going to talk to those guys this week, actually, the PWA guys. They didn't address this on stage. They talked about Edge a lot, the new Edge, right? And they talked about some of it. We should talk through some of the stuff they did talk about. But you know, one of the things that's going on with the New Edge that I think, you know, maybe should be highlighted at this very show, actually, is this notion of, well, it's based on Chromium now, right? And so we're going to install web apps through the browser, not through the store. And that's a big change. It's a big change for Microsoft. When Microsoft approached PWAs, let's say a couple of years ago or 18 months ago, whenever when that started, when they started talking about it, you know, their big innovation was, well, we know there's this mechanism that Google has at the time on mobile, and they brought it to Chrome on the desktop for installing apps from the web. But what if we made them discoverable through the store? And that was a model that made sense for the Microsoft of the day, because that's, you know, that's the app platform, et cetera, et cetera. It seemed like it would make sense for users, because why would a user care that an app like the Twitter app they're getting in the store is based on PWA technology? It would be like differentiating an app that was written in C versus C sharp or something. Like, who would care? You know, you just want the app. But it doesn't seem to have gotten a lot of traction. And so I think one of the things that is going to happen with the New Edge is they're going to promote app discovery, app installation, and app updating, because it occurs in the cloud anyway, through the browser, not through the store. Right. Doesn't mean the store is going away exactly. I kind of asked that question rhetorically a week or so ago. But I do sort of feel like, because of the natural evolution of the platform, that kind of thing gets de-emphasized, mm-hmm. and it's more natural for users to do that stuff through the browser. And that makes the New Edge even more important.
You know what I loved? The announcement. So first they announced that we're going to put Chromium in Edge. Then they announced we're going to put Internet Explorer yeah. in Edge. Mm-hmm. Is that a iframe or is the I understand it completely yeah. because there's a lot of enterprise apps yeah. that use yeah. IE. That's why yeah. Windows 10 came with IE. Yep.
This is the final piece of the migration puzzle for Windows 7,
I
right?
I just thought that was funny. That IE. There's IE mode in Credge. Mm.
But it's done smarter, right? It's tab-based.
I'm sure it's also sandboxed, I would bet.
Yeah, and it's also automatic for users. And so you, via policy as an enterprise or business or whatever, can determine which of your sites or whatever sites.
I love the 1998 website that he pulled up inside IE yeah. with the old style
but look,
gray
tables. This has been the problem.
Yeah.
You
know, I know.
Yes.
Moving people off of XP in the beginning. Now moving people off Windows 7. I mean, these are important customers to Microsoft.
This
they didn't always do Microsoft.
Right by
these guys.
This is very Microsoft.
Remember in the past, like they kind of didn't address the IE compatibility stuff.
Right.
And so you'd see third-party apps that would – or third-party services or whatever that would do it for you. You know, you could have right. these policies that a user clicks on a link in Chrome, let's say, and if it's a certain – if it's on a certain blacklist, it would open then in IE automatically. But now you can just do it from one browser. You know, so that makes a lot of sense for people, I think.
Yeah, I'm going to guess it's a safer way to do Edge. I'm sorry, IE stuff in Edge.
Yeah. Yep.
Right. And also to get everybody to go to Edge and not feel like I now still need IE. Yeah. Right?
Do you think they'll stop bundling IE as a result?
I do.
So it's, you know, they're never going to say it this way, right? Because it's a little bit negative, but it kind of shows you how much things have changed. Yep. When Windows 10 first came out, new browser, only going to be on Windows 10. We'll mm-hmm. still have IE for those people who need it. And if you're on a different version of Windows, well, tough. You should upgrade to Windows 10. Well, a lot of people stayed on those other versions of Windows, mm-hmm. and they started right. using Chrome. Congratulations, Microsoft. So you could kind of make the argument that what they're doing now, having Edge be available everywhere, having it be based on Chromium, and having IE compatibility built into it, is exactly what they should have done in 2015. And the world would be, at least the Microsoft world, you know, the Microsoft ecosystem, would probably look a lot different than it does today.
Right.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Yeah. What were the other Credge announcements? Ooh, so there was tracking one.
And I like collections.
Collections also.
Let's do tracking.
That one I wonder about.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, let's do tracking first because there's two aspects to tracking. There's the Google tracking, which they've removed from Edge, period. And then there's the third-party tracking.
Yep.
She's just saying yes, so I'll do it. So the way that Edge works by default, I think these two things combined are what's going to make Edge a no-brainer for virtually everybody.
I feel like they left out some critical information, however.
Okay.
When you turn on tracking protection, you know, the do not track switch on Chrome, on Brave, the privacy focused browser I use. The first thing that happens is a big screen pops up saying, you're going to turn this on, but don't expect every website to honor it. Most websites do not.
That's not what this is, though.
This is not that. Do not track. This is something different.
Do not track has failed.
Yeah, it's failed. So this is a replacement for do not track?
This is right. This is Microsoft's own thing. This is literally – actually, you know, all it is – I mean, honestly, and I don't mean to downplay it. It's important. But I think the reason they're – look, they've taken the privacy thing and running.
This is their opportunity. Yeah.
You can go into a browser today and you can say, you know, well, what kind of cookies do you want to support? You know, first-party cookies, third-party cookies, whatever. I think this is basically an enhanced version of that.
Oh, okay.
And they're putting it up with a nice big graphic so you can really see it and you understand.
Yeah, but I always turn off third-party cookies if that's all it is.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And by the way, that's off by default in Safari.
Yeah, yeah. It
should
be off,
it's not off by default in Chrome because Chrome is an advertising company.
Right.
Yeah. So if you think about the three choices, whatever the names were. I mean, I think they basically boil down to all cookies. I'm oversimplifying, obviously, but all cookies, first-party cookies only, no cookies.
Well,
you
this
know?
Is not a change, and, then. This is exactly...
No, I think it's more than that, but I think that's the basis of it.
They put it in big letters.
Yeah. No, I think it's a little bit more than that, but
now, here's a question.
Foundation.
From the day they said, we're going to put Chromium, you know, we're going to use Chromium as the engine for Edge, lots of people were wondering... if Microsoft contributes back something like this into the Chromium project, and by the way, they pointed out, nice job, Microsoft, that they've got hundreds of commits back into Chromium already for things like accessibility, which is fantastic. But if they start committing back these privacy things, will Google ignore them?
No.
Will they treat it like a fork? Mm-hmm. What's gonna happen?
I can't imagine that this is at Google, whatever, put in. Although, by the way,
tomorrow we'll hear some of this at Google I.O., I would think, right?
There was a rumor today that Google is about to announce some privacy controls for Chrome that, who knows,
maybe
might be the impetus for this, might be what this is based on.
Right.
But whatever Google does around privacy in Chrome, you can expect Microsoft to go further.
Yeah, and, because their ad business has failed, so...
they have an ad business that's growing, but tiny.
It's not just that their ad business is not as big as Google's or whatever. That's not really the point. I mean, the point is that is the point of Chrome, and that's not the point. Microsoft's not going to let that stuff sit in Chrome.
And it's part of a marketing effort to say it's not just Apple. Microsoft, too, in contrary to Google and Facebook, is a privacy-first company.
Ever since Apple started talking privacy, I said smart
move.
Microsoft needs to do the same.
And the word privacy was up there on the stage behind Nadella. What they looked like more cosmetic. They had – in fact, it reminded me a lot of the old Windows days. They had unrestricted – restricted or strict, and then balanced. They had three kind of generalized privacy settings, and you could drill down within those. That reminded me very much. I'm trying to remember what the Windows. It was in IE, something similar, right?
Right.
Yeah.
I can't remember what it was.
But you know, this stuff is kind of hidden in browsers now, and it's
very
obvious.
It's good to put it up front and big.
It is.
And put it in plain English and, you know, just so people can understand it.
Yeah. I think this is going to be, though, maybe an area of tension between Microsoft and Google.
You know, we're going to see. The Verge had a story about the story behind Microsoft embracing Edge, Chromium rather, and completely absent from that story is the one thing we've always sort of suspected, which is they have no high-level relationship around this at all.
Yeah.
Of course, the Google Chromium engineers or the guys who work on Chrome are kind of embracing what Microsoft's doing, but that doesn't speak to a corporate strategy on either company's behalf at all. And that's still an open question.
It's not a partnership. It's not even a
collaboration.
It's a cooperation.
Cooperation.
Yeah.
So, I think this is, do you think that really what is signaled here is an increased focus on privacy that Microsoft, because frankly, there are a lot of people who say Microsoft is not a privacy company. And there's a lot of talk about the tracking built into Windows 10.
Yeah. They want to be seen as the champion of trustworthiness and privacy.
Yeah.
But the competition they have is so low.
Right. The bar is low. Yeah.
And Google.
We've got a level set on this one, though. So All the tracking, there's no tracking built into Windows 10. There is telemetry built into Windows 10, and it's done for improving the product.
Okay, the, but tomato.
No,
I mean,
No. Hold on. The problem they get into is they don't let you turn it off, right?
Right.
And or worse, they say you've turned it off and they're still doing it.
Okay.
Which some people assert.
They don't let it. Okay.
Some people say you can turn off all the. I haven't tried this and I don't care.
I turn everything on.
But some people say if you take off all those switches, they're still sending stuff back to it.
You're not turning it off. They've always been honest about that.
Yeah.
You're not turning it off.
Yeah.
It's anonymous. It's done for product improvement and so forth. Fine. This is kind of like the Gmail man thing. You know, what's the reason we're doing this? Why are we reading your emails? You know, why are we looking at how things are working on your computer? Mm-hmm. In Microsoft's case, we're doing it to make the thing better. We're not doing it so we can sell ads to you downstream somewhere where it comes out of nowhere and you're like, oh, that's weird. Mary Jo and I were just talking about this phone.
I understand, and I turn it all on anyway. I don't care. But that's not the point. The point is, can Microsoft convince people who don't – I don't know if it's widely thought, oh, Microsoft, the privacy company. You ask people at Apple, they'll
say that. I think it's going to work.
I think so. They can convince people.
Yep. Microsoft is trusted by – let's say there's a – you know, if Joe Bob out there doesn't fall for this little scheme they have, I don't think Microsoft cares. What they do care about is that the enterprises that do in fact trust them. And I think that this – they are trustworthy to the customers that matter the most.
And Nadella pointed out, you have to be if you're doing AI, if you're doing cloud.
Right.
Trust is huge. I mean, the word was up there on the screen.
It was.
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
Yeah, I think the people who wear tinfoil hats and always are worried about what do they know about me through telemetry, they're not going to be convinced.
No,
right?
Never.
No.
Even Google has introduced controls to turn off. You can turn off your activity history. Right. And I think your location history.
Actually, Google's gotten very aggressive about this. I was just reading an article about
Because they're screwed.
Article in Washington Post where this guy saying Amazon's Echo sending everything back, and he had to point out Google stopped doing that some months ago.
Yeah,
right.
Google understands.
I feel like the vendors will get away with what they can up to a point, and then they'll be like, okay, now we got to stop doing that because users don't trust us.
Right.
So,
well, and there's
Gmail man. Remember that whole campaign? Didn't really help Microsoft that much.
No, there is a business imperative though to collect some of this data, especially for telemetry, but also for advertising.
I miss Mark Penn deeply.
I knew he was going to say that.
He was Gmail man. He was the Gmail man.
And that day when he disappeared in a cloud of sulfur when we were at the service event was one of the saddest days of my life.
Poor Paul. He idolizes Mark Penn.
Former Clinton pollster. Was he the toe sucker or was that somebody else? I can't remember.
Oh, boy. I don't know.
I don't think it was him.
He was Gmail man.
I know he was a marketing guy.
I think he had a necklace made of toes.
It was Morris was the toe sucker, another Clinton pollster.
Yeah.
So, anyway. I think actually Penn replaced Dick Morris.
Right. Right. So, I'm sure he planted the stories about the toes of the press.
I'm pretty sure
his middle name is Beelzebub.
Okay. It's rare, though, that you would listen to a Windows podcast and start hearing about toe sucking, so I have to apologize to those of you who are.
We can stretch the limits.
A little whiplash from that. Let's talk about collections.
Oh, yeah. Collections.
I thought that looked pretty cool. It looked like, okay, Megan said, that's Google Keep.
No.
So others say it's Pinterest.
I thought it was almost like sets, right?
To me, what this reminded me of was the tab management features in Classic Edge. And it's one of those things that makes sense as a demo. People kind of see, like, you know, they nod their head.
I could do that.
And then I think you go to use it and you're like, yeah, whatever.
It's interesting that Mary Jo mentioned sets because at the time I said, well, let's see. Because remember, this had a great sets. It was great. Was demoed. They were talking about it and then never shipped it. So we'll see.
I mean, it felt like sets meets set aside tabs and Edge when I saw it. I was like, so they have this idea that people want to collect things on the web and put it somewhere, but they haven't been able to figure out how to make it work well and how to make it intuitive. So I think this is another shot at doing that. And
you know,
again, we'll see.
Funny thing, they got this program. I don't know if they know it. It's called OneNote.
I know. I thought, by the way, as you were just saying that, I was thinking the same thing. And
yeah.
You know, isn't there some kind of little OneNote pane that could come down?
Wouldn't that be better?
Microsoft account?
It would.
I just, you know, I've been searching for a cross-platform way to share our travel. I make, before we go anywhere on our trips, a big travel notebook with all the PDFs, all the confirmations, a day-by-day diary of what we're doing and all that, and I share it with Lisa.
Yep. And how do you do it? Share it how?
OneNote.
Yeah.
I finally, I was doing Google Drive. I had a Mac-specific app, but that didn't work so well on non-Mac stuff. Google Keep, I thought about. Yep. OneNote's perfect.
Thank you. Yep. That's because that's actually what I use for this.
It's perfect for it.
Yep.
So I have a travel folder. I share it with Lisa.
Yep.
And then all of our trips are in there. She can update it. I can update it. Like, mm-hmm.
I've even done this with friends when they join us on international
trips.
Yeah,
exactly. You know? Yeah, here's your itinerary.
Yep.
If I get my travel agent to use it, it'd be perfect. So why doesn't – I saw somebody tweet this. Why doesn't Microsoft take the energy they're putting into this and give a little love to OneNote? You got a great product here.
Well, we could only speculate, right, because they didn't say anything about OneNote. Edge will work cross-platform. I guess
so does OneNote, and it's free on every platform.
I know.
But maybe, and I'm just guessing here, but maybe it's because it would require an MSA, a Microsoft account. And
I think it does, doesn't it?
Yeah. But, you know, how on earth, I mean, how else would you do this if you were using Edge without a Microsoft account and you had created some kind of a collection of things? I mean, you wouldn't be able to get that on your phone.
There's got to be some cloud component
unless
that you're logged into. Yeah.
Well, it's MSA based. I mean, that's how it would work.
Well, it's the same thing with Google Drive. You have to have a Google account.
Yeah. That's the only thing I can
do it. But yeah.
I'm not sure.
Yeah.
It ended up being after it's like I've been looking for all the years for something,
right?
And this is it's perfect.
Yeah. Yep. So we'll see. I mean, collections could end up like sets. Maybe I'll never get it today. Maybe if it does, it'll be like set aside tabs too, and nobody ever really used that much.
That was my reaction. It looked like a good idea. No one's ever going to use this.
We'll see. Yeah.
Yep.
Edge, they also pointed out, is going to be on Mac, is going to be everywhere, right?
That's right.
Except Linux.
Well, yes, but I've actually confirmed with someone from Microsoft that they're looking at that.
Well, they might as well if they're using Chromium. I mean,
Yeah, it would be not trivial, but almost trivial.
Well, you know, I don't know how modern browser architectures work, but in the old days, you had the engine, and that's cross-platform because it's Chromium. And you had what they called, Firefox still calls it, Chrome on top of it, which is a UI. And that's in CSS and JavaScript and cross-platform languages and would be easy.
Mm-hmm. So when you think about what they're doing right now, obviously they got to get this out on the big client platforms, right, which is all supported versions of Windows and Mac. Once that's there and they're just kind of iterating, there could be an effort to put it on Linux. And the Chromium stuff's already there. I think it makes plenty of sense. I mean, in the same sense that they have developers on Linux who are using VS Code, why not have the browser there? The F12 developer tools in the new Edge are based on VS Code, or styled to look like VS Code, maybe is the right way to put it.
Okay.
So we've got Richard here. If we want to do database next, should we?
Yeah.
Or should we?
Yeah.
Was there actual database talk at this thing?
There's a ton of database talks. Yeah.
Like I blacked out during that part of it.
Richard is going to make you care about databases.
Oh, boy.
We'll see.
Richard Campbell from .NET Rocks. I pressed this button. Oh, is he in the room with you?
He is.
Okay. Now I need to get an engineer back in.
We had trouble doing three screen before, so
no, I can do it. But hey, John, you've got a Skype box in the middle there. How do I?
Got your Skype box in my Skype call.
Put your Skype box in the middle. Again, Microsoft, please, no more conferences on Alex Gumpel's days off.
That's a request.
Just asking. I'm just saying.
Sure,
John. Okay, so I have Skype in the middle there. I don't want Skype in the middle. He's in the room with them.
Well, he doesn't appear to be online.
We've traced the
call.
No,
he's
back.
Not. Oh, I see you're saying he's not. He would be on a Skype. I get it. Oh, no, I was wrong. So is he in the room there?
Yep.
Is he online?
You guys have to just call him, right?
Yeah, we're going to call him right now.
Yep. You're online, right?
Yeah, I already pinged Alex.
Yep. Oh, no, Alex isn't there today.
Alex isn't there today.
There's the problem.
I've never seen Alex come up so often.
I know.
Especially on a day where he is not here.
He's really infrastructure, but sometimes infrastructure is important.
You Ladies need Alex and gentlemen, as a service.
From .NET Rocks, the source of the $500 bottle of Balvenie, I give you Richard Campbell.
Since you get one bottle of whiskey, you never know what's going to happen next.
I love that Abunda. I bought some, by the way, Richard. It was
good. Yeah, I was pretty sure I knew what happened next.
Yep. Okay, database time. I'm going to take a nap. Go ahead.
Nice. Hey, should we just run down the list?
Are databases the same as data lakes, or is that something different?
Yeah, data lakes are what happens when databases get tired.
You just get all floppy.
Yeah. You know, there's the input side of databases, right? You're taking in new data, Data lakes is sort of where you put it when you're done with it to do analysis on it. And certainly there's been lots of conversations about analysis here. But if I talk about the highlight reel, right off the bat, it's this idea of serverless data. So today, if you want to use Azure, you pretty much have to set up their version of Azure SQL the way you would normally set up any SQL database. And that's fine, except you basically have to predict the future. Like, well, how big is this going to be? What compute resources are we going to need? And so you either overbuy or underbuy. And so the fact that we can now do it serverless, the same way we do Azure Functions, where whatever you use is what you pay for. And honestly, I'm surprised it took this long. It's not a trivial problem, but still, it's like this is the way most people should be buying data. It's just literally based on what you consume.
I don't understand a word he said, and yet I feel soothed by it all.
You feel good about it.
I feel good about it. I think Richard just, you know.
It's very much like a $500 bottle of whiskey.
You are the Balvenie of data lakes.
He is. It's like auto-scaling, right? I mean,
it is, except that you auto-scaling, it scales up and sort of stays up, or even you dial it back down. But the big thing that happens with serverless is that you literally are no longer specifying how many CPUs, how much storage. It's if you have a data transaction, it gets handled. And you pay for the compute resources and the storage space that represents.
Whatever they may be.
And whatever they may be. And so the whole thing here is when you get that burst of traffic, when it's Black Friday or whatever the huge burst of traffic is, you're no longer wondering, did I turn up my database enough? Any more than I think about that with the website. You know, that it simply with other serverless stuff, it scales itself based on demand. And so the fact that we now have the database doing that too means you're not spending money foolishly. Like your data bill's going to go up because you had a good weekend.
Yeah.
Not because you turned it on.
Like AI.
I guess to some degree, the predictive model, but it's also just the architecture internally. What they were actually doing is getting further and further away from the old school relational database.
Right.
That we're no longer specifying all this stuff in advance with data models. We're just storing the data as it comes in and allowing you to analyze it the way you want to. I think it's not going to be easy for your average DBA who's just getting comfortable in the cloud and was okay with SQL Server in the cloud or with Postgres in the cloud to now think, oh, well, I kind of don't own a database anymore. I just store data. Mm. And that's it's creepy and weird.
Right.
But for those of us who fully embrace the cloud where it's like, dude, just give me the compute I need when I need it, this is a good answer. And it gives us the end of the solution. Like our networking is like that. Our compute resources are like that. Now, finally, our data storage is like that. Mm-hmm.
That was almost interesting.
And he hasn't even had any scotch.
No. I haven't brought out the whiskey yet. There you go.
What about the Edge announcement, this SQL on the Edge thing? Did you catch that?
I'm not sure exactly what they're talking about. Other than, what they're doing with Cosmos DB, and they're just getting better at scaling it more broadly. But they're putting more of the services that you would normally set up to speak to a database like Cosmos directly into Cosmos. And the classic
like
example.
Spark, right.
Yeah, Spark isn't the new example of that. But the fact that they had a MongoDB plugin. So it's like you can take your MongoDB connection string that normally would speak to MongoDB and just point it at a Cosmos data set. So these sort of bits of ceremony around how we connect to store data, the fact that those are going away, they're less and less on the code side. So for me as a developer, I don't have any rituals anymore to storing data. I just poke into Cosmos DB and say, here, hold this for me. Don't lose it and make it available within 30 milliseconds anywhere in the world.
Sure.
And then you just send me a bill for making that come true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was thinking more. They talked about Azure SQL Database Edge. Mm. I don't know if you saw them talk about that. So they described it as Azure SQL running on compute constrained devices at the edge. So even anything with ARM or x64 in it, and they're going to kind of scale down.
Well, that reminds me of the old SQL Express stories too, right? Where the same thing. It's like, I want the database to be on the device so that I'm no longer waiting for that latency to the round trip to the cloud.
Operations on the data locally will be faster, and then it can sync to the cloud.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Then you do that offline rather than wait. People wait.
Yep.
Thought that was big.
We've done it before. Hopefully, this is better.
Yeah. Yeah.
People struggle with multiple data stores.
Yeah.
As soon as the data is in more than one place, it's really hard. And if you hide it from people, so then you tell the developer, don't worry, you're just storing the data. Maybe it's stored on the edge. Maybe it's stored in the cloud. Mm-hmm. Then we have random performance problems.
Yep.
And it does it wrong at some point. You're not, it's just the data. Like, why should that be a problem? It's like, it's actually storing it in different places, and they're wildly different from each other.
Right.
So that can be sneaky.
Yep.
And did you see, Citus Data got acquired by Microsoft a while back, and they made the big announcement where they're just hugely parallelizing Postgres, which is a great database.
Yep.
And allowing it to scale really well. But I think it's really interesting. It seems like they've taken very much that same approach in design and applied it to SQL Azure as well. Mm-hmm. So it's still not a trivial thing to operate a widely distributed database. Like, it takes some experience, but the tooling's becoming more mainstream. So, it used to be you rolled your own for this sort of stuff, and it was voodoo. And the guys who were good at it got paid a lot of money. And now it's a product that Microsoft will sell you, by the compute cycle.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Are you excited? I know I'm excited.
I can tell you are.
Can you speak a little bit to the .NET 5 stuff? I kind of stumbled through it a bit, but.
Yeah, there's a lot going on there. But, there's an acknowledgement that there's a fragmentation of .NET. And it's not necessarily a bad thing. Standard has helped a lot.
Yep.
But you also realize that when Microsoft is maintaining all these different versions of .NET, every time they go to add a feature, that feature costs 2, 3, 4, 5 times more because they are building it multiple times, testing it multiple times. We already saw with .NET Core 3 this move towards this idea that all of the underlying bits of .NET, stuff like the CLR, there should only be one.
Right.
And so actually in the framework 4.8, the runtime bits are the .NET Core runtime bits.
Okay.
So they're using one code base, and that makes our lives better. But there's a bigger motion now to say, can we make all of these flavors of .NET be one set of code? The standard has helped, but since most of the people that are compliant with standard are working for Microsoft now,
right?
Can we just write fewer lines of code so that you can use them over and over again?
Okay. Mm.
And so that's ultimately what we're trying to get to, one .NET. And I think that's pretty exciting.
Functionally, as far as going from .NET Core to the .NET framework, where are they from a feature parity standpoint on Windows? I mean,
yes, because from a web developer point of view, they've got it nailed, right? The challenge now is they're trying stuff like WPF and WinForms. They're Microsoft specific. WinForms is a very thin layer over HWin handles in Windows. I'm not saying you couldn't make a Mac version, but that's not a small hoop to jump through. And they're certainly not promising anything like that. So, but this idea that you have this .NET Core that is cross-platform and available for everybody, and then you have an SDK for Windows that gives you WinForms and WPF.
I mean, .NET Core 1.0 was really focused heavily on web.
Well, and it was even a small subset. It was just the first
time. But it was still a small subset. Yeah. Right. So obviously over time, they've improved the feature parity. And then again, I'm sorry, I interrupted you, but on Windows specifically, are we close enough? Is that?
No. When 3 with the new SDK comes out, which is supposed to be later this year, then you're going to have WinForms and WPF available. And they are different versions. So they're already admitting, you would hope that as a developer and you've got a 4.8 app, and more likely you have a
4.8 app would work on .NET Core 3.0?
You would expect it to.
Yeah.
But now the question is, what parts of Windows is it depending on? So if it's depending on WinForms, the version of WinForms that runs in 4.8 is different from the version that's going to be in the SDK for .NET. And the main thing is high DPI screens. It's
missing from the
old one. It's in the new.
Oh, that's okay. That's actually an improvement.
It's a great improvement.
I was thinking about it in the opposite
direction. No. There's more features coming.
Okay.
The downside is it's not going to render pixel perfect.
Okay.
Because as soon as you play with high TPI, things are a little bit different.
Yep.
And so what you're hoping for is that I can pick up on a WinForms app and that was running in 4.8 and just recompile it on .NET Core 3 with the WinForms SDK, and it'll work.
Okay.
There's going to be something.
I'm straining at the edge of my developer knowledge, but tell me if this is correct. Yeah. What this means is that you could have a developer who has created an app. It doesn't matter what SDKs you're using per se. Other than that, maybe it relies on .NET framework version something. It could be anything, 4 point something. It's possible that there are features there that are not going to be in 5.
Well, and they've already said there's a few things they're not bringing.
Well,
WCF. They're not bringing workflow.
Okay.
Right. And obviously,
so
they're not bringing web.
You would stay at a back level version.
Yes.
And you would just not move forward with the.
Well, and also, you're talking about quote unquote legacy apps anyway. Like these, if you've got a web form site, the chances that you want to rewrite that are low. Right. And the fact that they're not going to do a drop across upgrade because they can't means you're going to have to take care of it. Now, I mean, there's good ways to take care of it now. It will run in containers. Like you can keep that app healthy, not bound to an old machine or anything fairly well. You're just not going to get the same feature set.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Okay. But if you can write to one of the newer versions or to .NET Core today or now to .NET 5, you're good for cross-plat.
It's until you depend on the Windows stuff, right?
On the Windows side, there's a giant list of things that are Windows specific because of the legacy of the .NET framework and because of they're bringing in WinForms and WPF and so forth.
Because people want them and they do want to be able to move forward on that. And I think the WPF stuff's going to be pretty great.
Yeah.
The WinForms, I know they'd been working on a version for a while, but they always ran into this pixel parser problem.
Sure.
And so they really didn't want to ship it as a drop-in upgrade and have people angry. Because it wasn't pixel perfect.
Right.
So better to this model where it's like, look, you're recompiling. And so you should test. You have to look through your code and you have to look at those screens and decide, is this acceptable? Is this what you wanted? Or make adjustments.
Interesting. Okay. Okay.
Cool.
All right. I guess.
Yep.
I was surprised that got not even a mention in the keynote today.
Well, they talked a little bit about the last build as well, where they were far earlier on, and they're much further down the path now. Like, we should see this ship by the end of the year.
They just never gave a date when they were going to get rid of .NET Framework, right?
Implicit that obviously as the feature set catches up, right, in .NET Core.
Right.
I think what they had said before was that they had had stopped developing new features. Maybe I'm wrong about that on .NET Framework.
Yeah, they're talking about putting into maintenance mode, but I'm also, mostly what they're doing is gauging our reaction.
Yeah.
Right.
Like Microsoft doesn't like ever leaving people behind.
Sure.
They're trying to leave the fewest behind if possible. I like the pitch was the Bill Gates always leads the parade because he figures out where the parade is going and runs in front. Right. Like, it's not a bad idea. Yeah. We are the dog. Like, we wag their tail. Right. So if we insist on something, if there's a substantial barrier that stops people from moving, they're going to keep doing things. And certainly they've committed to 10 or 20 years of security patching.
Sure.
The question is, what new features did you want?
Yeah.
They're talking about C#8. This is a mature language, and they spend a tremendous amount of energy trying to backport it to older versions of the framework, and they're just not going to do that anymore.
Yeah.
If you really want to take advantage of the new features in C#8, move to the current framework.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
And I think I got to, in some ways, some people just sort of sit back and go, we didn't have to do that? It's like, no, C#7 was ported back all the way to 4.2. Yeah, yeah. Like, they kept it around for a long time, and it's really hard. And so let's talk about the other side of this. If they do all of this positioning, they consolidate the framework and you need the new bits to run the new versions, the rate of feature creation goes up. They can now make more stuff because they're not backporting. They're not cross-platform testing as many different versions of things. So they can actually increase their cadence. We should get more stuff in the next year or two as that weight comes off and they can start building the things that people are asking for.
It's the big difference between Apple and Microsoft. Yeah. Microsoft has a hard time saying goodbye, and Apple aggressively will move forward and just cut off support.
Come with us or you're lost, right?
Yeah.
But I also think that I also appreciate they're doing this in the open, essentially. Like all of the things I've just described, they're in YouTube videos from the teams having those debates and reading their responses from GitHub issues about them. Right. They didn't come to this casually. This is not some mystical vision that came out of nowhere. This is looking at all of the problems that folks are having with .NET and saying, what's the best way to solve them?
Right. Mm-hmm.
And having the debate in public.
You should write a book about .NET. You seem to know a lot about this.
Fascinating idea. Who would do that?
Cool. Thank you.
Yeah. Is there anything else, Michelle, that you think is a big deal or has been overlooked? Or
You know, I'm still digesting everything that's going on. It literally happened at these announcements a couple of hours ago. I know we got some pre-briefings and things, but I'm still trying to figure out how all that stuff lands.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty excited. I really do like that some of the new data features. Like, we're modernizing in an interesting way. And the new analytics tools are great. Like, what are we getting? We're just getting more.
Right.
Yeah. The set's getting richer. So, yeah, it'll be cool to see what happens next.
Nice.
Well, thank you, sir.
Thank you.
A pleasure. Thanks so much.
The world famous Richard Campbell, .NET Rocks,
world
run
infamous.
His radio. World infamous. And party master. It's all about the whiskey. Do you do a whiskey podcast?
One bottle of whiskey.
I know. I'll never forget it.
Don't open this bottle. This bottle is hazardous. That's the bottle you want.
I am now Mr. Cask Strength to my friends.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Everyone who was present at that episode has a different version of the story.
It's like the blind men and the elephant.
I was on the first hour for like 10 minutes and then I was done and you guys had two more hours to go and half a bottle of whiskey drank.
Except for
MJ. She took one look and went, nope.
I got that.
There's always one adult, you know.
I got that Abudna you recommended and that is delicious. I really do
lovely,
like that. Yeah, that's really
good. I have kept a bottle of that in my house ever since that show. We never do not have Abudna.
Now we have a show title, so that's good.
That's true.
Thank you, Richard.
My pleasure.
Talk to you again. Boy, I'm glad he was here to make me feel better about whatever the hell he was talking about. He's so calm. It just makes you go, I think that's all going to be good.
I'll have to get the Audible version of his .NET book so I can fall asleep to the soothing sound of Richard's voice.
And then you start your compiler. He's kind of the ASMR of .NET.
Like the automatic memory relocation?
Yes. No, that's something else, yeah.
Okay.
Let's take a break. We're going to expunge Richard from our queue.
Pop Richard from the stack.
Yeah, pop him off the stack, and we will continue to poke Paul and Mary Jo in just a moment. But first, let me poke you as a business owner. You know what your biggest fault? You might have all the security in the world, and you're careful. You know what you're doing, and you know here we have firewalls and intrusion detection devices, all sorts of things. But your weak point is always your employees. It really is, and we talk a lot on security now, but it's something called APT, Advanced Persistent Threats. The idea that nowadays hackers target your business with a phishing email that's aimed at particular employees. They call it spear phishing. Once they get a bite, they get into your network, and then they will quietly roam your network for months collecting information, passwords, data. This is what happened to Sony Pictures Entertainment. 6 or 7 months later, boom, we got it all. 91% of all successful hacks start with a phishing email. So the key is to train your employees to be cynics. I mean, that's really the bottom line. And how do you do it? PryLock Security. PryLock Security. It is awesome. Best-of-breed security training platform that automatically creates, enrolls, manages, delivers, tracks, and reports your phishing tests, your training, your security briefings. If you have compliance mandates, it's compatible with that. Let me tell you, this is a really brilliant way because I think a lot of people just say, well, we're going to bring a guy in, he's going to tell you, and then he leaves. No, PryLock's much better than that. PryLock sets up for the first part, a 3-day baseline phishing test. So they send your employees phishing emails, real phishing emails, either ones you create or ones from their database. They have a database of 1,100 of the most effective phishing emails. Employees who bite it get kind of logged, right? So you'll know before you even begin the training exactly, that's the baseline, exactly where you stand. And you're not when you do this, you're going to be shocked at how vulnerable you are. Then, And by the way, each user, each of your employees gets a custom page loaded with resources specifically to their vulnerabilities. That's really cool. Then they take the security awareness training. And I did that. It's fun. It goes along. It's like a kind of traditional training thing. And then a hacker breaks in and says, look, let me show you. Let me tell you what I'm up to. And that's what's cool about this. You're going to learn not just a set of do's and don'ts. That's not effective because hackers are a moving target. You're going to learn the psychology of hacking, of why they hack, what they're looking for, and how they get you to click those links. There's a 10-question final assessment that's suitable for all your compliance mandates. Then after they take the test, PryLock automatically schedules and runs 24 more additional phishing tests throughout the year, average of 2 a month, right? And they don't know they're coming. So it's a really good way of seeing, did they learn? And if, by the way, if your employees click on one of those links, they get automatically enrolled in specific injection training videos. The tests include opening the phishing email, clicking a link in the email, downloading attachments from the email. Here's a good one. You see this all the time with Microsoft Office documents. It says there's a macro in here. We're not going to run it for safety reasons unless you say to enable it. You'll see how many employees go, yeah, enable that. Turn that one on. And finally, the worst, data entered for credential theft. This is your bank. What's your password and login? If they fall for that, they get a special training. PryLock makes it really easy. You don't have to have an IT department to do this. You can do it yourself. One-click setup, full year's training, 50 to 5,000 employees. It'll take you less than a minute. If you are more experienced with IT, there's a lot more customization you can do, including custom phishing emails that are, you know, have the boss's name in it or, you know, targeted in ways that, truthfully, bad guys will do. There's even a send a friend a fish, which your employees will love, where they can send a friend or a colleague their own phishing email. And when they click, they get a page. I love it. There's also, I think this is a really good thing. We all know somebody who falls for these things time and time again. If you're listening to this show, you're probably one of the people who has to go over, you know, to Uncle Joe's house, say, you did it again, didn't you, Joe? Yeah, me too. You can get a single license gift card that will test them with two phishing emails for a full year and then give them resources if they click, which they will, after they do. So it supports what you're telling them all along. PryLock offers one-year security programs for companies as small as 10 employees for just $200. Because they have a very efficient system, it's 70% less than comparable programs, very affordable. But you can't afford not to get your employees this kind of training. You can never learn all the ways hackers might con and trick you, but PryLock can show your employees the psychology being used against them so they aren't the next victim. You can find out more at PryLock.com/twit. And if you use my name as the promo code Leo, you'll get 30% off. PryLock.com/twit. We thank PryLock for supporting Windows Weekly, for providing something that I think every company needs. And we thank you for supporting us by going to PryLock.com/twit. Back we go to Seattle, Paul and Mary Jo. They are at day one of Build. And the tension, excitement is building, right?
it's budding, maybe.
Richard didn't talk about
the tension in the air.
This is electric. Mm. He didn't talk about fluid framework. I thought he might.
No. Yeah.
You want to say something about that?
We can talk about it.
Okay. Yeah, I'm curious. Yeah. I understood as a developer. That seemed to me like something a developer would want.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it did. Microsoft didn't put a whole lot of details out yet about this because they're saying it's going to be out in SDK form and in some Microsoft-developed apps late this year. So they didn't give us a lot of details.
I thought the SDK was interesting. Does that imply that you'd be able to make your own Fluid Framework apps?
I believe so.
So it's not going to just be built in. So what are the benefits of Fluid Framework? What does it
do? There's two parts to it, right? There's a new document model that for all the old timers listening sounds a lot like Olay, object linking and embedding from back in the day. The idea is you can build compound documents combining different pieces of data and components from applications into a single canvas type thing. And then there's also the multi-person co-authoring part of it that they showed.
They had cool demo where they had nine windows open and they typed in one language in one, and then it automatically populated the other windows with the translations.
That was cool. That was cool. And that's because the Fluid Framework is going to let people who are authoring various kinds of content work with virtual agents, right? So the conversational agents, the translation APIs and agents, those are going to be able to work with the co-authoring environment and this new document object model all together to create these new kinds of web-based apps that pull things from different places and remove the silos, basically, from apps. So you know how you have Word, you have Excel, you have PowerPoint. What if you could take pieces of each and kind of pull the things you need, like an Excel spreadsheet or a diagram, into a single compound document and have everybody working on it together at the same time in co-authoring mode? That seems to be what Fluid Framework is, Paul. Is that kind of a good explanation?
Yeah, and you actually, you know, your comparison to Olay, I think, is really smart because it's accurate. And the difference is that it just scales so much bigger today than it did back in 95 or whatever that was.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not just, you know, compound documents. It's almost like the elimination of, or the attempt at the first step toward the elimination of top level apps as being a thing.
Right.
Like you don't really, you kind of have a canvas where depending on what you're working on, you might have a different set of tools and those things will come from different apps. But maybe if this thing evolves correctly, we won't even think about it in those terms. Mm-hmm. But I'm fascinated that they're still working on the same themes that they did for Windows 95. But instead of, you know, bringing apps together on a single platform back in the day like they were doing then, they're bringing these things together universally across web and mobile and desktop platforms rather as well. It's interesting. We didn't get to see a demo of it until today. So we had kind of learned about it. It's hard to conceptualize until you see it, and then and I think that's where the Olay thing comes up. You're like, oh, okay, this is familiar.
And they said the first apps where this is going to work is things like Words and Teams and Outlook. So that makes a lot of sense. You know, places where people already are collaborating and they want to kind of take it up a level, but make it more that you're not in, say you don't have to be in Teams to do a certain task or in Word to do a certain task, that these things could all be combined somehow into a web canvas. I kept using the word web canvas.
I wonder sometimes if this is going to change some of Microsoft's legacy apps. You know, you get into this weird situation where you have these big monolithic applications in the Microsoft Office suite, and then they have these newer, really small, thin and light mobile apps, and they're all Office sort of, but you can almost imagine it's essentially a web or a mobile app that brings in the parts of Word only when you need them, you know, and that it is a modern, different type of experience, you know, that we're still kind of hardwired to think, you know, I have to write an article, so I have to launch Word or in your case Notepad or whatever the app may be. But I mean, you that's how you're kind of trained to think that way. We do it on mobile phones as well.
Yeah.
You know, I want to share a picture with you. Well, how am I going to do that? Maybe I'll use Messages. Maybe I'll use Google Photos. You think app. And I wonder if this isn't the beginning of a move away from an app-centric model to this kind of people-centric thing they've been talking about.
Yeah. Could be. Could well be.
Yeah.
So that's all we really know about Fluid Framework right now. One more thing. It was codenamed Prague, I read somewhere. And Steve Luco, who's a technical fellow at Microsoft, says he's been working on it since 2016, I believe.
Wow.
So I guess this has been in the works, and supposedly none of us knew about it till today.
I can't wait till they come out with the modern version of what is it, like ActiveX.
You know? Well, that's when you said Olay, I get chills, but
I know.
But that was a different time.
It was a different time, and I don't mean to say this is like Olay, you know, 5.0 or something, but
I don't. So, by the way, ActiveX was insecure because they stripped away too much, right? I don't know that the component object model or DCOM or whatever is inherently insecure. Like the idea there was, it was object oriented, right? So I think we're, you know, that's not the way they're going to develop this per se, but there's a very clean sense of private and public data and private and public interfaces, you know, and you can, as the component creator, you know, create whatever interfaces you want so that these things can interoperate publicly. Yeah. You know, who knows? I don't know. I have no idea how this thing is architected. I'm sure it's completely different. But we just mean conceptually, not
No, I mean, but I always thought it was actually it was a good idea that the whole model was a good idea. But, you know, the mistake they made with ActiveX was allowing arbitrary code to run on your computer.
So, but remember, at the this is 1996 or so, right? And so you have this really rich interface for sharing information between applications on a Windows PC. It needs to run in the web, which was mostly dial-up.
That was the problem, right?
What do we have to strip away?
Right.
How about all the security stuff?
Right.
You know, we got to make this thing really thin and light so it works on the web.
Right. And allows basically any website to run a native Windows program on your
desktop.
The notion
that you could do essentially do Olay and Olay type things on the web at that time was super exciting.
No.
We just didn't
understand.
Yeah. Oh, I thought it was fantastic at first, and then you realize it's a...
So we've learned a lot. I mean, we've come a long way.
Yours,
Now the technologies are there. Every computer is connected to every other computer in the world.
Right.
It kind of makes sense.
It's a completely different scenario today. Yeah.
So they see it really as a collaboration framework. Primarily.
It sounds like that, the way they're describing it. Okay. You know, I think they're trying to keep people from jumping from app to app. You know how right now, like, say you want to do something in, like Paul was saying, in Word or Excel, you think, I have to go to an app. What if you didn't have to go to an app, but you were just in this one big place where you could do the things you would do in Excel or in Outlook or whatever?
If you and I were collaborating in real time on a Word document and we needed to insert a chart and we wanted to use Excel...
Right.
Getting up and running in Excel on the web and then both of us getting in there together would be a completely manual offline, you know, changeover. And I'm sure someone looked at that and said, well, wait a minute. What if what if the collaboration was the point at which, the you know, we entered and then you just add from there? So I don't know. I you know, it's still early days. It's hard to tell, you know, how this will be done. But it looks like a good idea. And it looks like it's – I mean, obviously, in a, you know, the demo could have been canned for all we know. But it looked – it looked like they had something interesting up and running.
Truthfully, that was my problem with everything they did on stage. Everything was so carefully either videoed ahead of time or controlled.
Yeah.
And,
well,
and a few of the
not everything, Leo.
There were a few that broke.
There was that notable exception.
And no, like, for example, we didn't talk about it yet, but the thing they showed with Cortana doing the turn-by-turn conversation, that video, you know, where she was saying, okay, reschedule my walk outside.
It wasn't accurate. Oh, right. That one. That was not nightmarish. That was
I want to do that. I do want that.
Yeah.
I don't know anybody who actually works that way though. That was almost manic.
That Microsoft has made where the woman's like, you know, checking into her hotel or whatever, and she's like, "Hey, is that meeting blah blah blah?" And like, "Oh, just reschedule this. Well, do we have any time in the morning?" And it's like this giant ponderous conversation. Now, like, by the end of it, it's like me in a shopping mall. I have to go running out of there. Like, I can last for like 3 minutes, and then I'm like, no, enough.
To me, it looked like a Saturday Night Live skit.
No, but you know, okay, think of turn it down, right? Like, so who really has that many meetings, right? Yeah. But what if you could say, hey, we're taping Windows Weekly today somewhere in the Sheraton. Where is it?
Right. That would be good.
Okay. Could you give me a map of where it is in the hotel? Like, that would be awesome, right?
Yeah,
but it was
a
canned video, so
it was. So you don't really know how far along they are or how close that is to ever becoming a reality.
You know what it is? It's like a if you work in a traditional workplace and you have these meetings, maybe one every couple of days or once a week or whatever it is, and it becomes this monotonous thing.
It's horrible.
It turns interactions with technology into that.
Yep.
Thing all the time. And
all
this
time.
Is the part of work I hate.
Yep.
Like, I know.
You know, I don't know.
Well, one of my friends always says Microsoft designs products for people who work at Microsoft. And if you know anybody who works at Microsoft and you look at their calendar, their entire day is meeting. It's like unbelievable. So for them, this probably seems like the perfect solution to the
it's
problem.
Heaven.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. For me, I could see uses of this if it ever comes to pass, but I would be like, I have like maybe 3 meetings a week at most. So I would just be saying one day, like on Monday, oh, what meetings do I have this week again? It would be more like that than every second.
When do I brush my teeth today?
Right? Yeah.
I would use this to undermine every meeting I was supposed to be into, like to see how many days I could go without actually going to a meeting.
Reschedule with Tom for tomorrow.
Even if it required me to just talk to this thing all day long. just to keep out of the meeting.
Then there was a weird HoloLens demo with Mattel.
Yeah, so we had seen that one before. We had seen that. Remember when they announced the HoloLens 2 and Paul was in Barcelona? We saw that exact demo.
Oh, that was that okay.
The Azure Spatial
The dope demo that was really cool and dope. And then she draws on it, and it looks like, I mean, like a kid scribbling on this thing, and like that's how Mattel designs toys, really?
Yeah, I don't know.
Have you seen their toys, Leo?
Maybe it is. Look, I'm making a hand.
Sell it.
Oh.
No, I thought the one about the virtual assistants was interesting because everybody thinks Cortana's just going to go away, but this kind of showed, no, this is how they're reimagining Cortana.
Tool. It's not a consumer tool.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, Google's been showing this kind of thing for years. Everybody's been doing this.
It's called full duplex, right? When you can talk to it and it recognizes what you're saying. Like, what's the weather tomorrow? What's the weather the next day?
Yeah, it also understands context. Yeah. So it holds context from question to question.
So that's perfect.
Yeah.
I hope this comes to be. I don't know when we'll ever really see it. It's based on technology Microsoft bought last year when they bought Semantic Machines, but we didn't really get a sense of like, so how close is this? And I know you're going to add it to the bot framework and to Cortana, but like how and when? We didn't really hear any of that.
And then they showed that scary witch's hat Cortana device.
Leo, we've decided the name of this is the Cone of Shame.
But then it disappeared. It was like, I thought, oh, is this like Danny's Starbucks cup from yesterday's Game of Thrones? Yes. Was it accidentally left on the table?
No, it's triangular, so if you leave it on top of your car, it doesn't fall off. When you drive
Perfect. Yeah. And then they dictated, which is something we've seen like for years from other companies, real-time dictation. I do that, frankly, all the time. And it wasn't even perfect.
Right.
And then they acted like, oh, look how smart it is. It can understand medical jargon and programmer jargon.
And instead, it's like a Doonesbury cartoon about the Newton.
Well, but also it's easier to do those constrained vocabularies than this is a general vocabulary. So I don't know.
Yeah.
I would lift some of those out, to be honest.
Yeah. I don't know. I feel like their goal of making meetings easier and more productive and making kind of the way you handle productivity overall easier on you is a good concept, but I feel like we've heard this for a long time and we just have not really seen a lot of advances that have come to pass in our lives. So I love the idea of this, but I keep thinking, one day, who knows when? We don't really know.
Right.
At least when Bill Gates had those videos, it was, you know, one day.
Yeah, you knew it was somewhere way out in the future.
Your home will be alive.
We have held onto what I think will be the most relevant news for you.
I know what you're going to say.
Well, now.
WSL2 coming in June.
And why do you think that it's important? I'm sorry. I didn't need for this to be a trick question. There's a hidden secret to this. Sorry. Let me step back.
Native Docker? I don't know why.
No.
Oh, the new terminal. Oh, you like the new terminal. No.
It's much more exciting. Are you sitting? You are sitting down.
I am on a ball.
So this will be the first time that Windows ships with an actual Linux kernel.
Oh, that's weird.
So today, WSL essentially...
It's emulation. It's like WAN.
Emulates Linux.
Yeah.
Starting with probably 19H2. It seems the version that will come out this fall. There will actually be a Linux kernel included with Windows.
That's hysterical. Is it Debian?
It is. They're not saying
it's custom built. Here's what they say: we will include an in-house custom built Linux kernel.
It's GPL. It's the long-term servicing version 4.9. I think was the version.
They just did 5.1 just came out, but 4.9 would be probably long-term service.
4.91.
At some point. Why don't you just wipe Windows and put Linux on your gosh darn machine?
Shut your mouth.
Honestly, I mean, okay.
Linux, look, it's baby steps. You know, you get baby steps.
Yeah, baby steps towards putting Linux on your machine.
Really, all we're doing here is feeling out the audience, see how comfortable they are with this, and we'll do a little more next time.
So that's wild, though. So it will not be. So what it does right now is Windows sits as a layer and emulates the kernel. Responding to calls, it's actually going to have a kernel, It's at this point practically like dual boot system, it sounds like.
Yeah. So here's what's in. Tell me what you think about this one. So the way that WSL works today is you can apply various flavors of Linux from sort of a command line user interface perspective, right? And you get those things from the store.
Yeah.
And so if you want to use the I don't even know if versions are available, actually.
There's a ton of them. There's Debian. There's Ubuntu, which is the default. There's Arch. There's tons of them.
So what do you think the possibility is that in the future they might actually let you pick the kernel version as well? Or does that not make any
sense? I'm guessing not, because the Linux kernel is a pretty modular kernel with hardware support in the modules, and I'm guessing that's why this is a custom kernel. This is Microsoft doing kernels specifically for WSL.
So in other words, they wouldn't let Debian or somebody.
No.
Okay.
They're using the base kernel anyway. Right. It all comes from Linus.
Okay.
It says we're using Linux to refer. Linux is often used to refer to the kernel and the GNU user space, but with WSL2, we will not provide any user space binaries.
Oh.
Interesting.
Big change.
Well, is it though? Because
it was all user space. I mean, currently it's all user space.
It says the Microsoft kernel will interface with a user space selected by the user.
Right.
That makes sense.
Right.
Yeah.
It is now kind of. I mean, that when you choose in the store,
you're
getting
something out of the store.
That's what you're choosing. You're not getting a kernel. You're getting a user space.
Right.
But now the kernel will actually be included with Windows.
That's really interesting.
Yeah.
It's a much better way of doing it, I have to say.
Yeah.
Because it'll be that's
in the next version of Windows will be optional.
Honestly, it really is where they're headed.
I know.
It sometimes feels like that.
The next step is to make it a Linux distribution that supports Windows programs.
Well, look at Azure, right? More than 50% of the workloads are Linux on Azure, right?
What's interesting about the Linux stuff, though, to me is Leo has said this, and Tim, our former dev guy, has said this. And so even though I don't use this, I've heard people say it, you know, which is it's really neat that there's this Linux thing, but it's not Linux.
No.
And you run into problems where every once in a while.
Weird stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that this is the step where they try to eliminate that.
Yeah.
You know, I bought that new Windows laptop, and I really tried to use it as a Windows laptop, and I put Penguin, the Linux distro that we were talking about, on it, and WSL and Docker. But what I realized, these are all kind of half measures that developers use to get it to sort of the environment they sort of want. Mm-hmm. And you'll do that if you need to be in Windows. If you're a .NET developer, or you have to run, you know, Office, or you have to run Adobe Suite products or line of business products.
Yeah.
But if you really want Linux, mm-hmm. almost any PC you buy can very easily be made into at worst a dual boot computer, and and if not a full Linux computer. And so I ended up just wiping Windows off my ThinkPad X1, and I put Linux on there. It's beautiful. Yeah. It's a wonderful. It's a thing of beauty.
It is
a joy forever. Thing. Because it's instead of ersatz Linux, you know, of Linux. Yeah, it's just Linux.
I get it.
But for a developer, that's really what you want, I think. There's people like Richard. I'm sure Richard needs a Windows environment. And so for him to have some Linux utility is nice.
It depends on where you're at.
Depends where you're at,
what you're doing.
Yes.
Yeah. Exactly. So they'll support. Yeah, you can go either way, I guess.
But it is interesting they put a kernel. That's the right thing to do. It's just very different that's what all of WSL was really originally, to provide the interface between Microsoft's own kernel and these Linux calls.
I guess what we're going to call the user space stuff. And right.
They're completely
flipping.
And so
now they're going to have it.
Yeah.
So supposedly this improves performance for some operations by up to 20%.
Yes. One of the problems, and I've talked about this with Film Girl, with Christina Warren.
Yeah.
Is that small files operations in WSL are horrible. They're very, very slow. They know this.
Okay. They clearly do. They keep mentioning file operations.
And they have to fix it. And, you know, it's so painfully slow that it's like, well, you know, how much am I willing to put up with?
I kind of wonder if this is part of the reason they jumped to 20H1 builds with Windows 10 because of this feature. And they kept saying, we're working on something. We can't tell you guys what it is. Maybe it was this. Maybe it was, hey, there's going to be a Linux kernel in there. And we didn't want anybody to know.
Wow. We got to get Rich Turner on because
we do.
What it looks like.
Rich Turner's going to be a little busy this week.
Yeah, I know, I know. What it looks like is that they finally said, you know, this was a good start, but really we got to have a Linux kernel to do it right.
Yeah.
And then in less technical news, the new Windows terminal will support multiple environments and will support tabs.
And GPU acceleration.
GPU acceleration for the emojis, you know, the emojis.
Got to get those emojis looking good.
Yeah. Remember, because Rich Turner got in trouble for saying there were going to be tabs, but not via sets. He implied that anyway, and that's what kicked off the whole sets is dead thing. And but now it comes out that the terminal is going to get tabs.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, that's right. It should. I mean, most Linux kernels are tabbed. I mean, this is.
Yeah, but I mean, maybe that's he was just like, who cares about sets? Like, we get
tabbed.
Tab
terminals. By the way, I'm looking at the WSL blog post from Microsoft. They said 20 times faster when unpacking a zipped tarball, which is something you do all the time, 2 to 5 times faster cloning from Git or NPM install or CMake. Those are the things that you're doing all the time. So a 200 to 500% increase. That's huge. A 2,000% increase is even, I mean, that's a big difference.
So that's the difference between native and emulated.
Yep. Well, it's also, there are a lot of theories about why file operations were so bad in WSL. One is that it's actually Defender, because Defender scans every file.
It could be.
And some people say if you just turn off the file scanning.
No, it's like the antibiotics. Antibiotics are trying to fight off the intruder in your system.
Yeah, Linux is a cancer. We're trying to kill it.
You know, you're going to get a fever.
Yeah.
That's how it goes.
Yeah. It's that cancer. Linux is here again.
That's right.
Anyway, I think that actually is you're right, Paul. That is kind of a earth-shattering statement.
Well, you and Dr. Pizzo were talking about it in the press room, and you were saying, so is there a Linux kernel?
So the thing that we got ahead of time didn't say anything about this.
No, it didn't.
So I sat down. I'd written my story about that stuff, and it didn't seem notable to me in any, you know, Windows terminal, great, whatever.
Yeah.
And Peter turned his laptop to me. He said, read this paragraph and tell me if anything sticks out for you. And I read, and I said, kernel? He goes, yep.
Wow.
I said, where did that come from? And he says, well, and he went to go find Rich Turner, and he finally got an answer. And then they published the blog post, which wasn't available at the time. So I need to go I'll write this up later. But the basic gist is this is a much bigger deal. And it's probably one of the surprises they were talking about.
Oh, yeah. It's got to be.
Because they left it out of the pre-briefing stuff that we got.
The kernel also will be fully open source.
Interesting. So we'll then see what they're doing. Yeah.
You'll be able to look at it.
Yeah.
And then it's Microsoft Linux.
It is. They built
it. Actually is.
Yeah. It's their own custom-built kernel, so.
I hate this world.
Paul loves Linux. Don't forget.
Well, it raises an interesting competitive question. You know, one of the things that Nadella has said in previous incarnations is we want to be everywhere our customers are, right? But the best experience will be on Windows. That is notably missing.
Yeah.
That
those
second clause.
They don't believe in complex sentences anymore. We're going to end that one right at the comma.
Yeah. So the best experience is whatever you're using. We don't care.
Yep.
Wow.
That's right.
Who would have thought this?
I know.
I would have gone Mac 10 years ago if I knew this was going to happen.
Bring back my Amiga.
Come on, Linux kernel field guide.
Well, by the way, so not to beat this, I mean, not to go back in time completely. You were just saying, you know, as a developer, you get the Windows thing, you do this, you do this. You're trying to make this thing into a thing that it isn't. I mean, I used to go through that with computers. You know, but I spent $5,000 or more on an Apple IIgs back in the late 80s trying to turn it into an Amiga. And then finally I said, why don't I just buy a damned Amiga? This is stupid. Like, you know, I think we
have the choice.
Make those mistakes.
Well,
you know what they think.
And to be completely fair, I do that with the iPad. I see people doing that with the iPad all the time.
Yeah,
no, this is a computer. It's a computer, really.
Yeah.
But you're like jumping through horrible hoops, and you're so brainwashed, you don't even notice the pain you're inflicting on yourself.
You're traveling with a bag of spaghetti that is all of the dongles and stupidity that you need. Yeah.
Yep.
We watched, this is a few years ago, and this is a little unfair, but we watched someone, it might have been, I think it was at this conference, in the press room, take out a bag, take out an iPad, take out a keyboard, take out, you know, they took out like 30 different pieces and assembled it into this thing that was sort of like a laptop. And I was like, is Steam going to come out of this thing? Like, what are they? What is the point of this? Yep. It's like everyone else just opens their laptop. Mm-hmm.
What a world.
What a world. Well, it just shows what weird nerds we all are. All right, let's take a break. There's still stuff to talk about. This is and this is just day one.
I know.
Actually, there isn't that much more to talk about.
We're pretty much
covered it. So let me talk about our fine sponsor, Atlassian, and then we can wrap things up with party time. Let's talk about the parties. Partai. Atlassian is a name that any developer knows, especially if you do agile development. You know Jira. We've used Jira for years. Both in development, but actually our IT team uses Jira. And it's a really great tool for keeping track of projects. So you always know what stage the project's in, who's responsible for it. It is a fantastic way of tracking everything you're up to. And then the way we use Jira is we use it with other Atlassian tools like Confluence. We use Confluence to kind of memorialize what's been done, to talk about how the workflow works, document it. That's really one of the reasons I love Atlassian. Because I'm not the guy really down there with the tools, but I really think it's very important when our IT teams are doing stuff that they document it, that they communicate it back to stakeholders, the boss, customers, and Atlassian facilitates all of that. These days, IT is at the heart of every operation. It's a cloud-based world. IT teams have to plan and execute. They have to do it better and faster than ever before. Apps are more complex. The interactions are more complex. You really need to be smart, and you need to be able to coordinate between operations and software development teams. IT is at the center of the most important business workflows. That's why you need the tools that help you do your job right, and that's where Atlassian comes in. Software tools designed to manage this kind of complex collaboration. And again, it's not just for developers. Atlassian offers an affordable, reliable suite of tools for all kinds of teams, all sizes, from DevOps to Agile to IT apps to Ops to ITSM, whatever's next for your organization. Atlassian provides the technology backbone to help modern IT organizations plan, service, and support exactly the kind of change that propels your business. You need Atlassian. We're proud to say we're an Atlassian house. Jira, Confluence, if you've got a lot of code databases, you've got Bitbucket. Then if you've got Ops, you've got Ops Genie and Status Page to help you better detect incidents, coordinate response efforts, and again, communication, keep stuck customers, stakeholders, your boss updated. Your team with Atlassian can choose the right tool for your current framework, but trusting that as you grow, as your needs change, Atlassian will grow with you. And it all integrates seamlessly with Jira and Confluence, so you don't have to bounce from platform to platform. Like all of Atlassian's products, the tools for your IT team are easy and free to try. Just go to Atlassian.com/IT and find out which Atlassian offering is right for your team. Try Atlassian today to see what IT can be. Atlassian.com/IT. We thank them for their support of Windows Weekly. We thank you for supporting Windows Weekly by going to Atlassian.com/IT. Back to Build. Paul Thurrott, Mary Jo Foley. See, I was quizzing you about your hangovers because I thought that last night was the Blogger Bash. That's tonight.
No, last night was tomorrow. We went to a press event. Tomorrow. And let's just say there were lots of pink drinks consumed.
Because we had, I know where you were, because on Twit last night, mm-hmm. we had Dan Rubino from Windows Central.
Okay.
And he said he had to go to the influencers party. Is that where you guys were?
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah, we actually were.
Did you do a lot of Instagram selfies? Did they have a pop-up?
Yeah, we were hanging out with Dan after we shut down that particular event. We went down to the hotel bar with Dan.
Okay.
And
I love
let's
Dan,
just say
by the way.
More
whiskey
was consumed.
Yeah. That must have been, I would like to go to that event where you got Campbell, you got you guys, you got Rubino, you got Sam's, you got all the big names together. That would be so much fun.
Yeah, the morning after, I have to say, was not as fun.
What a surprise.
I set an alarm for 6, didn't get up. Yeah. Brad called me. I faintly heard the sound. It was the phone ringing. It was him wondering where I was, and it was 7:15.
Well, I have a tale of woe, too, because Karsten told me the keynote started at 8.
Yeah.
So I, too, got up at 6, rushed over, got here at 8.
Oh, that thing did not start on time either, but it didn't start at 8. It started at
8:30 was supposed to be. It would end up being at 50.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I had to sit through. Actually, it wasn't so bad. The student presentations for the science fair thing that they did.
Yeah, but you know what? You know what that is, though? The reason you resent that is because you see that as an extra hour of sleep you could have had.
That's exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
That's not the wrong way to look at it.
It doesn't matter if what was on that was okay.
The kids were nice. They were, it's actually one project somebody's going to be a billionaire from.
Oh, yeah.
Where there's a lens and some AI software, Azure-trained software on a phone. They take a picture of your iris. It tells you your blood sugar without a pinprick or any.
Yeah.
If that works, and they said it did, that kid's going to be a millionaire, a billionaire.
It's a company called Theranos?
No. it was the name that leapt to mind. Mm-hmm. But, I was impressed by that. Anyway, it was kind of like a Shark Tank. They had three teams, college, collegiate teams, that had made it all that way. They had Mary, the CFO, Microsoft CFO. They had founder of Replit, and I can't remember some other guy. Anyway, it was cool. That's judges. It was cool. But I had to sit through that. And what was the 20-minute delay?
We don't know.
They just started late.
I'm sure they were rebooting HoloLens to make sure that first demo went up great.
Oh, my God. My heart broke for those guys.
I know. They've got a YouTube video up now from the rehearsal for the keynote where it actually works, if you look for it.
Oh, to have to say, well, it worked in the rehearsal.
Exactly. Oh.
It was such a dramatic fail. It didn't even start up and fail or anything. They just stood there, and they didn't even stand there very long. They just stood there and go,
oh, well.
Okay.
Yep.
Thanks for coming.
Yep.
God, what a terrible way to begin.
I know. It was just
bad. Oh, my God. I feel bad for them.
Yep.
And by the way, John Knoll is a legend. He's the creative director at Industrial Light and Magic, invented with his brother Thomas, invented Photoshop.
Yeah. It's sad that his entire legacy is ruined by this.
he's the Michael Bay
of
the HoloLens.
No, he's fine. At least he never made a Transformers movie.
Yes, okay, I'm reading a Variety right now. They've said the delay was because they were set to go on stage and the demo wasn't running, so they stalled to try to let them get work. That's bad.
And now we're getting Microsoft news from Variety.
Yeah. Hey, you know what? They actually cover a lot of tech news, surprisingly.
Well, Yanko Redkins, who used to be at Giga Ohm, is over there now, and he's actually
an Industrial Light and Magic. You know.
Well, that's what I'm saying is this is not some, a couple of geeky guys doing it. These are big names.
It wasn't a great start.
So I'm trying to find the YouTube video, but all I can find is stories about how it didn't work.
I know.
Awkward demo fail.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. I feel bad. I would have liked to have seen it, but.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll find it on YouTube. I've seen a couple links, but no, I can't find one, of course, save my life.
Reminds me of a James Brown concert. I covered a James Brown concert in San Francisco, and he was like an hour late. And the band comes out, the Soul Generals come out on time. In fact, I think they get fined.
You get to modernize it a bit so the kids understand it. It's like a Guns N' Roses
concert. Yeah, right. And Axl may never show up at a Guns N' Roses. But so the band goes, so they have an announcer. He goes, ladies and gentlemen, the hardest working man in show business, James Brown. And the band's going, dun, dun, ba-di-da-dim, dun, ba-di-da-dim, dun, ba-di-da-dim. And they do that for a half an hour. And then the guy comes back. Nice. I mean, literally, guy goes, ladies and gentlemen. So I interviewed James Brown after the event.
Yeah.
And he said, I can't do it. Good God, my hair had a blowout. apparently there was some sort of hairdo accident.
Malfunction.
Because, he had quite a pompadour.
Yeah.
And I guess it just.
That's unbelievable.
This is not as bad as that, but.
No.
More people were watching.
Yeah.
So your Blogger Bash is not tonight. It's tomorrow.
Tomorrow night.
It is.
At the Pine Box, which is a former mortuary.
Yep.
Yep.
Hence the name.
7 till 9.
No RSVP.
I'm going to show up late. I'm not going to be there at the beginning.
Why? Where are you going to be? What do you got?
I'm going to be having a steak dinner at Ruth's Chris. But I will be there at the end. And I think it's fair to say we stay late, right?
Yeah.
We'll be there.
Yeah.
There's some other bloggers going to a dinner thing, and I want to make sure I hook up with some of them. So
so now really the truth comes out. This is just basically a big social event for you, Paul.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Richard Campbell said to me, and let me see if I can get this quote as close as possible to what he said. He said, I'd like to buy you a steak dinner.
Wow.
At Ruth's Chris. And I said,
nice.
I was crying a little bit. I said, that is the nicest thing has ever said to me.
Now, are you going to go for the New York steak, the T-bone, the sirloin, or the king of all cuts, the porterhouse?
Yep.
Yep.
Well,
all of the above.
Suffice to say, I am a kingly sort.
Yes.
What I strongly recommend at Ruth's Chris, all the steak is fantastic, right?
It comes out on an iron plate sizzling.
Yeah. I believe they cook every piece of steak with a stick of butter. It's wonderful.
Oh, it's so good.
And then
it's totally keto. That's the beauty.
It is totally keto. They have a fantastic lobster bisque. Strongly recommend getting the sherry. Anyway, I will be doing that. But I will also go to the Pine Box for the Build Blogger Bash as well. And there'll be a bunch of people there. I know the insiders are coming. So Donna Sakar and those guys will be there.
Oh, that'll be fun.
Yeah, it'll be good.
So no RSVP, 7 to 9, Pine Box, tomorrow night. Just show up. And if you're in the area, you got to go. I would be there. I wish I was really planning to come to this event. And then Google stupidly put their dev conference on Tuesday.
You know what's funny? I don't know if I mentioned this last week or if I even knew this by our show last week, but Microsoft finally sent out our schedules at some point last week, and they built Google I/O's keynote into our schedules.
Oh, that's funny.
So we wouldn't be in a meeting because so many of us would race back to the press and the watch.
Well, that brings me to my announcement, which is 10 a.m. Pacific tomorrow, 1 p.m. Eastern, 1700 UTC. We will be doing the same thing we did this morning. The Google I/O conference kicks off. We will do the keynote, cover that. And this week in Google, Wednesday, we'll feature Jeff Jarvis. Jeff and Jason Howell and the whole gang are down at Google I/O for the event tomorrow. Jason's doing all about Android there. And Jeff Jarvis will be up in studio on Wednesday. So
cool.
We shift gears a little bit from Microsoft to Google I/O. Windows Weekly, of course, is done for the week. So we're going to move iOS today into your slot, 11 a.m. Wednesday. For the iOS folks, so
just let them know if they need help with a beer pick or whatever. We're here.
I miss the beer pick. I do.
I know.
I do. I want that saison you mentioned.
I bet we'll get a beer pick next week that is based on something Mary Jo had.
Mm-hmm. We will
this week.
Yeah, Rubino was talking about Untapped and how you are the queen of Untapped.
Somebody has to do it, you know. It was funny. I was last night having a drink after I got in, and I had a beer, and then somebody bought me a wine. And so a Windows Weekly listener came in, and he sat across from me, and he had this weird face, and he said, "Wasn't sure it was you. I saw you were drinking a wine."
I know. It's not your reputation.
He's like, "What's going on?"
Hey, Linux kernels and Windows, anything can happen.
True.
Paul Thurrott, Mary Jo Foley. You'll find Mary Jo all about Microsoft.com. And you're filing during all of this, right? You're going to have plenty of stories. And Paul is, of course, at Thurrott.com. And his books at LeanPub.com. Coming soon, The Field Guide to the Linux Kernel Inside Windows 10.
He's laughing, but he's secretly
I'll help you write that. I'll help you write that, yeah. Thank you, Paul. Thank you, Mary Jo. Thank you all for joining us at this special time for Windows Weekly. You guys have a great build. Have a great Blogger Bash. And we'll see you next Wednesday, 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern, for Windows Weekly. Bye-bye.